Oh, fucking hell, really?
Welcome, Secret Movie Clubbers, to Secret Movie Club Podcast 31, where I am dealing with very little sleep, and I was just told I'm a maximum dad brain. So
yeah, you just said Secret Movie Club.
Did I? I got a Secret Movie Club, homie. I'm breeding them like that Tiger King dude we talked about 4 months ago.
That was a great episode, by the way.
Oh, thank you. You want to buy a Secret Movie Club?
Yeah, sure.
That can be our children's line of merch.
I love it.
Oh, dude, our millions. We just funded Secret Movie Club for the next 3 years. Although there's something a little cultish about Secret Movie Cubs.
Yeah.
Also, there's the LGBT meaning of cub.
What is that? Dare I ask?
Well, it's like there's like bears and there are cubs.
Well, I'm going to read up on that and get current with the mojo lingo. But anyway, Secret Movie Club 31, where we are talking about Stephen King novel to movie adaptations. Although I think this week we can make acceptable like the first It, which was a TV miniseries. And if you guys want to talk about the various Shining, Stand, yada, yada, I think wasn't Gerald's Game basically straight to Netflix?
Yeah, that's still a movie, though.
Yeah, whatever you want to talk about. But Stephen King is an industry unto himself. We have a lot of fans on the Secret Movie Club team of Stephen King, and clearly his novels have been adapted into a myriad of movies. So that's our topic. Who's with us today? We got a special guest returning from The Evil Dead.
Returning champion.
Caitlin Riley. Give it up for Caitlin Riley.
Oh, I love when people clap. Yay. Hi, guys.
Caitlin Riley, who is the host of the Riverdale Register, currently on pause, as many things are with COVID, because I don't think they're making many new Riverdales, and also a pop culture writer.
Aren't they filming again, Caitlin?
They are. I think they got shut down for 2 weeks because of COVID. But I think they're back at it now, I think.
Because I saw like a video online of KJ Apa and Camila Mendez like washing their mouths with some sort of something before, which I'm guessing
so they can kiss?
So they can make out, which is basically all they do together. But I don't feel like that's going to be super effective.
I hope that was a joke, because I imagine that they don't just give everybody mouthwash and are like, this will be fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm excited though, because season 5 seems crazy and I love a time jump. It's going to be very One Tree Hill season 5 or 4, or whatever that was, which was a very big deal for me in my youth. So I'm excited to bring it back.
Hi, it's Daniel. I didn't prepare anything to say after that. After that, you had a great intro, Caitlin.
What else do you have to say, Daniel?
No,
I just mean nothing. Just Daniel Ott.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I see what you did there. Thank you for setting that up, but I screwed it up.
Beep, beep. It's Connor.
Oh, I blacked out. it's me.
What are you drinking, Edwin?
I'm drinking a Coke, man. I'm drinking a Coke.
Okay, yeah. I don't want to hear the words blackout and Edwin ever mentioned again in a sentence.
I've just never seen someone hold the sody pop and then be like, I blacked out.
I'm trying to mask out drink Coke, you know?
Apparently a lot.
No, I respect it. I respect it.
I like anybody who drinks actual soda, because I feel like in LA, especially, it's like so much like LaCroix or whatever. But I drink a Diet Coke every day at 8 a.m.
And my name is Craig. I'm the founder programmer of Secret Movie Club. It's wonderful to have you all here. Today is going to be long and digressive, but ultimately rewarding, like Stephen King novels themselves. So,
well, we'll see about that.
I'm just calling it. You got to play like Earl the Pearl Monroe. Sometimes you know what you're doing, sometimes you don't, but you still get the win.
I meant more saying that Stephen King's novels are satisfying at the end, as much as I love him.
Oh, that's true. Well, we'll get into it. I'm sure we have some different takes on Stephen King. Announcements at the head of the show. We are now in the middle of October and in the middle of our Halloween-a-thon. This upcoming week on Thursday, I never thought I would say this, but only because I'm totally out of the pop culture loop and I was kind of woven back in by Edwin and Daniel. We are doing an encore of Hocus Pocus, Disney's Hocus Pocus. Of all the movies we did at our parking lot cinema, if you asked me which one would get the encore, I would not have predicted Hocus Pocus, but I kind of got it. It was fun. There was a talking cat. Bette Midler was a hoot. Sarah Jessica Parker was great.
Babe.
Kathy Najimy, always solid. Yeah, Edwin was particularly enjoying Sarah Jessica Parker the entire
she's
time.
A babe, man, she's a babe.
Like wolfing out.
Yeah, you reminded us.
When she sings her swan song in the sky, Edwin walked toward the screen.
And then on Friday, we're doing Get Out, Cabin in the Woods. On Saturday, we're doing Exorcist, The Conjuring. And on Sunday, our family movie's Addams Family. I will say Exorcist totally sold out. We just have 30 tickets left to Conjuring. Get Out, Cabin in the Woods, moving to sell out. Addams Family as well. Hocus Pocus as well. So thank you guys. Also, we are hard at work on our secret, well, Connor is right now, on our Secret Movie Club Radio Hour episode 4, the Halloween horror anthology episode. And we also, by the time you listen to this, we'll have announced our Halloween night double feature because it's a Saturday. So we're doing a double feature. We are doing John Carpenter's original Halloween and Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. So we'd love for you to come join us. That's going to be Saturday, October 31st. And that's it. Let's keep it short. Let's get to the meat. And if you want to write us, you can write us at community@secretmovieclub.com or podcast@secretmovieclub.com. And if you're a vegetarian, a pescatarian, or a vegan, I apologize that I said let's get to the meat. Let's just get to the substantial, nutritious thing that keeps us going, keeps the energy going. Boom. All right. Stephen King, cinema. Caitlin Riley, pop culture writer. Take us away. What is one of your favorite Stephen King novel to movie adaptations?
This is really hard because I felt like I watched it last night and I feel like maybe I had a different opinion when I first watched it, but Dr. Sleep, the new Stephen King, I guess probably one of the newer cinematic theatrical releases that we've seen. I really liked the book when I read it, but I was always like, I have no idea how to visualize this, like even as I was reading it. And I thought that Mike Flanagan did a really good job with the True Knot and how their kind of whole magic worked. Like I actually felt like it was a really good adaptation of the book that was kind of amorphous at times. Like you weren't totally sure what was going on. But yeah, I found it a little bit slower upon my rewatch last night.
I have a question for you. And maybe really quickly, guys, let's just go around the horn, although we're going to get to everybody. How many people here are big Stephen King novel fans?
I've read scattered. I don't know. I don't follow his new stuff, but I do. I have read a mini.
Yeah, I am a big fan, but it was something that I was kind of like didn't really dive into until my 20s. And so it's been the last like 10 years going through a lot of them. I've read quite a bit of them, but quite a bit still only means like a quarter to a fifth of his books because he has so many. I have three ones that I love. I think two of them we share, Craig, which is The Stand and Wizard and Glass.
Oh yeah, those are in my top three. The only one you left out would be It.
Oh, it's my other one also. It is maybe my favorite book of all time at this point. I profoundly connect to that book, and maybe we can talk to that.
So Stephen King, most people are aware of him, even if they don't read him, just because his novels and written works are constantly being turned into TV shows or movies. But he's a horror writer who started actually in the 60s. He was publishing short stories and then novels under different names, or at least trying to get them out as early as the late 60s. He really came to prominence with Carrie, which I believe was published in 73 or 74. And from then on, he basically just wrote hit after hit after hit after hit after hit. And for a long time, people appreciated Stephen King as a popular writer, but not as a writer of literature. And then weirdly, at the turn of the 21st century, there was this reappraisal where a lot of people came on board and were like, whoa, hold up. He writes a lot. And even in the great novels, there's sort of like stuff that he's sort of an overwriter, but his great stuff is great. And now there are a lot of people who look at him as one of the major literary figures of American literature of the last 30 or 40 years. Other people still sort of refute that and say, no, he's just a popular writer of horror. Dr. Sleep would be the sequel to one of his most famous novels, The Shining, which Stephen King famously, he hates the Stanley Kubrick adaptation, which ironically is the most beloved and known of all the Stephen King movie adaptations. Stephen King hates it.
I should say, I think he's kind of mellowed out and he's admitted that he thinks it's a good movie. He just thinks it's a bad adaptation of his book.
And I actually completely agree with that. I was actually going to pick The Shining, but then I kind of reevaluated. I thought it'd be more fun actually to discuss Dr. Sleep. But yeah, because when I was growing up, I would say The Shining was one of my favorite horror movies, period. And I read the book probably like 5 or 6 years saw the film for the first time. And I completely agree with Stephen King. I think it's a really bad adaptation of the novel. Well, I guess it depends on what you think of in terms of adaptation.
It's like a thematically bad, because I think King is a very warm writer. Despite being a horror writer, he writes with a lot of humanity for his characters. And Kubrick kind of is a pretty cold director. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Jack's arc doesn't really exist in The Shining movie, but it does really, it's his story, I think, in many ways in the book. And you completely lose that when you have this movie, but the movie also has some really interesting things about it, like just the symbolism, and obviously the cinematography is so gorgeous, and it is genuinely scary. But I think that the thing I liked about the Dr. Sleep adaptation was that you kind of got a little bit of the best of both worlds.
You should say that the Dr. Sleep adaptation is both a sequel to the movie and an adaptation of the book, which is a sequel to the book. But the original Shining movie and book are very different, especially towards the end, in terms of like the circumstances of the endings of those. And so the movie had to figure, Dr. Sleep had to figure out this kind of like middle place to go. And it actually does a pretty good job of that, I think.
Yeah, I will say that like I don't love the version of Dr. Sleep where they kind of recast everyone, but I don't know how else you would do it if you wanted to truly make like a cinematic adaptation sequel hybrid thing. That's probably my least favorite part, because I think it really does kind of take you out of it, because the whole time you're like, Henry Thomas is not Jack Nicholson. Yeah. Like, he's looking like, he looks kind of like him, but he's not him. I just think it's really, I really like that book a lot. I remember like reading it like at an airport in like a couple of days, like a couple of hours. Imagine if I was at an airport for a couple of days just with like a copy of Dr. Sleep. But Mike Flanagan is such an interesting horror creator, I guess.
Is he the director of Gerald's Game as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think he's kind of, in my brain now, I don't know, he feels like maybe the premier King adapter right now. I think he has a really firm understanding of the tone. And actually, I've watched for the first time, finally, The Haunting of Hill House, his 10-part miniseries last week. And I've been watching the new release, The Haunting of Bly Manor, this week. And both are excellent. And it's funny, and we'll get to it with it a little more, but The Haunting of Hill House, in case you're wondering what The Haunting of Hill House is about, it's about a group of kids who, as adults, have to come back together and confront some horrible stuff that happened to them as children. So
it's very, very Stephen King. And Bly Manor has a little bit of it, too, yeah. I think. Not as much, but... Well, no, yeah, it does.
It's a little more of a romance.
Yeah. It's great. I love it so much.
My King selection, keeping in the horror thing, would be Frank Darabont's The Mist from 2007, which is a movie that when it came out, I feel like was not super well regarded. And when I saw it, I was kind of confused, because I thought it was both a really great throwback to sort of B-movie aesthetics, while also pushing a third act and individual moments that I still think about that are very haunting. And does that great thing where it not only hides the monster, but also keeps all of its focus on like sort of the humanity fading from the people as they're pushed to these desperate measures. As a King novel, I've never read the original novella, but my assumption, as it usually is it's a father who is protecting his kids and also trying to be this hero in a circumstance where everyone around him is slowly giving in to the horror and having to make selfish decisions to protect themselves versus thinking about the group that they're with. And things sort of spiral from there. And I genuinely think, I don't know, I actually don't know if it ends the same in the book, but it is a shocking end. If you want to feel awful, you just watch The Mist. You will not feel good when that movie ends. You'll be satisfied with the movie, but you will not feel good.
I like that ending.
Yeah, I love it. But it like, yeah. You need like a day. You're like, okay, well, put on some like Sufjan Stevens and Phoebe Bridgers and just live with that.
Stephen King also is, in my opinion, an amazing writer, because he's as good a short story writer as he is a novelist. And that's not necessarily true, although many novelists write short stories and vice versa. Like, I love Hemingway's short stories. I think he's a brilliant short story writer. I'm a little iffier on his novels personally, even though I think the novels on a craft sense are amazing. I think the thematics in Hemingway novels are a little forced, whereas in his short stories, he's a little more loose. But Stephen King is just sort of a master in the short story form and the novel form. And The Mist is a novel. Or I'm sorry, is a short story. It's not even quite a novella. It's even a little shorter than that.
When I was going through his stuff to make this list, I found that most of the adaptations I like best come from his shorts. Stand By Me, things where I feel like a filmmaker in a 2 to 3 hour span, a short story gives you the most work to not only adapt it and be fairly faithful, but to add things that a film uniquely adds to the art. And sometimes that gets lost in the bigger adaptations. Like Caitlin was talking about, I wasn't a fan of the Dr. Sleep book, and then I really liked the movie. And that could be tied to that I saw The Shining before I read The Shining, and so Kubrick's vision in my brain is like my definitive thing, even though I think The Shining book is incredible. And then I read Dr. Sleep, and I wasn't feeling it, but then the movie, I was surprised by how it corrected things that I took issue with, especially regarding the third act, which sort of just takes The Shining book's third act and kind of repurposes it. It gets a little wonky. And just to take it right from there with Mike Flanagan, I think Flanagan as a horror director has a really interesting thing because he is hyper-focused on character. Like they were saying, I just finished Hill House a week ago, and talking about with It, part of the failure that I saw in It Chapter 2 is it's supposed to be a group of people that come back together and have to reevaluate and like figure out the trauma they experienced. And I feel like the movie kind of lost me in that. But Hill House has these siblings that come together and have to face the trauma of their childhood. And it's like this mental, it's almost like a psychological thriller in the way that trauma affects us no matter how hard we escape it. And by making it a physical manifestation of a ghost is really fascinating. I'm very pumped to start Bly Manor?
Yeah, great. I love it.
Flanagan's just got, he focuses character before he focuses in the scares. And I think that, especially with Dr. Sleep, is so effective because it's about sort of what Danny as an adult has to deal with. And I think King captures that a lot in his novels, and I think Flanagan really understands that.
I think they both understand how trauma, that the scariest things are also the saddest things a lot of times, and that the things that are horrifying to us are horrifying because we can't imagine how genuinely heartbroken we would be if they happened.
One of the things that I find interesting about cinema and movies is that I actually think it's really hard to adapt novels into good movies. I think it's actually a bit of a losing endeavor. I love Ulysses and I love War and Peace, but I just could never, and I know people are like, oh, you make them limited series. I don't know if I buy it. Movies to me are the most like music. I actually don't think they're at close to the novel or the theatrical work, even though a lot of people say they are. That's just my own thing. And so I've heard a lot of people say that it's much easier to make a great movie out of a mediocre novel or a short story than it is to make a great movie out of a great novel. And I would just say that I think what Stanley Kubrick did was he read The Shining and he was like, okay, that's one thing. And now I'm going to do something totally different, but I'm going to take the thing that I like from that. And I get why King, as a novelist, hates it, but it's sort of funny to me that King, being what I think he's a very intelligent guy. Anyway, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole there, but I don't know that he has the movie mind, because if he really had the movie mind, he would actually understand why Kubrick had to do that.
Well, admittedly, when he hated it, he was also extremely high on cocaine.
Right, but I get it from a proprietary sense, too. Like you guys were saying, I mean, Jack, in the end, saves his son. I mean, the whole point of the book is that he has a moment of clarity, of alcoholic clarity, where he allows Danny to leave the hotel because he realizes he's the mom. I mean, that is a beautiful ending. I get it. And King totally jettisoned that. Or I'm sorry, Kubrick totally jettisoned that.
Well, I want to talk about it. I want to talk about the book for a second. If people don't know, It is a novel with two sort of alternating time periods, one in the 50s with the seven kids who all basically come face to face with a monster, Pennywise the Clown, who's maybe a spider and maybe three floating orange lights.
But definitely an alien.
Some sort of ancient
Lovecraftian
alien evil.
Yeah.
I guess the true form is the lights, is these three swirling lights, but they never really can see that. And then 30 years later, them as adults have to come back to the town and confront Pennywise again. And it's very much so about how the trauma we experience as kids affects us as adults and being able to face that trauma. And it's a very personal book for me. I identify with a lot of those kids. If you find a picture of me, you'll see that I probably identify with Ben, the fat kid. And I'm not looking for any rebuttal there. It's just true. And that sort of yearning love, being young and being in that situation. I also identify with Eddie a lot because he is constantly anxious about everything. But the big thing for me reading the book It is it didn't hit early on. At the beginning of the book, the main character, Bill, the first scene in the book and in every adaptation is Bill's younger brother, Georgie, getting killed by Pennywise. And it didn't hit me then, but about like halfway through the book, there was a section describing from like Bill's POV about his parents and how they were reacting to it. And this is very personal, but when I was 2, I had a brother who was a year older than me that passed away. And it was one of those things where I was like, ugh. Like suddenly, like, it was like a lightning bolt got struck through me. And it's a novel that stayed with me quite a bit because it is a very being a super only child, being an only child by default, by function of a death, is a very unique thing, I would say. Not in a negative way, it's not unique. It's good that it's unique. And so I really liked It Chapter One. And part of this had to do with that emotion because I thought they did such a good job. I was like bawling watching that movie at times. I mean, I was bawling reading the book. The book made me cry more than it made me scared. And so I think It Chapter One's a pretty great adaptation. I do kind of agree that Chapter Two is a mess.
But Connor, just jumping on that, I when you started to talk, I wasn't going to say anything unless you brought it up. But I think you point out something really key about King. If people don't know this about King's own autobiography, he never knew his father. King's dad bounced when he was super, super young. And so he grew up with his mom and his brother. And when his mom got sick, he was really poor. And his brother had to shoulder a lot of that load, and King tried to do what he could do. And they also became caretakers of some other family members, some grandparents. And King was very poor. And so I think when you read King's books, this identification with the working class, this identification with broken families, this identification with the underdog, this identification with loss, this identification with trauma courses through everything that he does. But as you guys were pointing out, in a very warm way, in a very weird way, King actually and continues to be very optimistic.
I desperately want to meet him. He seems like he'd be a cool guy.
Totally.
His corgi looks exactly like mine.
I didn't even realize that he had a corgi.
Yeah.
I should know that.
Molly, aka the Thing of Evil.
Adorable. I don't know if anybody has ever read it, but when I was in high school, it was actually assigned as a summer assignment, his book On Writing.
Oh, it's great.
It's great.
It's great. Yeah, I love it. I feel like it helped me so much as a writer, but it also is just such a good, almost like a memoir on its own. So if anybody hasn't read it, I highly recommend it.
I credit that book with getting me to drop the use of adverbs.
Yeah. that is still my downfall in many ways. So,
Connor, before we leave, because it is mammoth and we're going to come back to it. King has called it the most Dickensian of any of the novels he ever wrote. He said that's as close as he ever got to Charles Dickens, who was a hero of his. I think it also clocks in as one of the, if not the longest, along with The Stand. I think it is 1,000 pages.
I think it is longer than the original version of The Stand, but shorter than the longer later version of The Stand. I'll finish talking about it real quick because it'll segue to Edwin, because I know the last part of this is going to make him mad. But so It Chapter Two, I liked, even though I agree with Daniel that it's a big mess. I liked it because I thought both those movies really understood. I think they really got the characters. Maybe I'm grafting some of that on to the movies. I think the first one maybe more so. I do kind of wish, I think if you took that exact same cast and you did like a 10-hour Mike Flanagan miniseries on Netflix, that would be maybe the perfect adaptation of it. But one of my least favorite adaptations, genuinely, is I really don't like the miniseries version of it from the 90s, other than Tim Curry. Tim Curry's incredible. He's great. He's magnetic. But here's the thing. Bill Skarsgård's also good. Pennywise is not the issue with either version of it. The characters in the miniseries are really awful and bad. And I don't care about them.
I rewatched it kind of recently, maybe like 3 years ago. And yeah, it's also kind of like very cheesy. Not Tim Curry's performance, even though, I mean, you can read that as cheesy.
It is. His performance is cheesy, but it's cheesy in a, like, there's like an animalistic side to it that makes it scary too.
No, I just feel like everybody else's performances, it feels like very hokey in a way that the movie doesn't. The movie feels more like when there are jokes, the movie is in on the jokes. The comedy comes from the movie, not from you kind of cringing at the like, okay. Also, they kiss on the mouth a lot in the miniseries, and it's like, why? And then I was like, is that supposed to be a nod to the famous sewer scene?
Yeah.
I am not sure. It's very strange.
When I was in middle school, the It miniseries was like a rite of passage, because everyone was like, my parents said this is one of the scariest things ever.
Oh, it scarred me. When I saw it, I was like in second grade for the first time. It scared me to death. And then when I rewatched it a couple years ago, I was like, what?
Yeah, I think I was in like 7th or 8th grade, and my buddies and I got together and watched it. I've never been more disappointed by something that I thought was not scary at all at that age. As a kid, horrified, but at that age, I was like, this is, my parents are scared of this? I talked with Craig, and I'm really curious to hear your thoughts, Connor. I know that the book is structured kids, adults, and the director of the It Chapter 1 and 2 has said that he has a cut that he wants to do that would recut the film as a singular thing with those in it that would give a little more characterization to the adults, who I think kind of have the lesser story.
That's the issue with the way they adapted it, because I think that first movie kind of just works as its own thing, as a standalone.
I like the first movie.
And I think the problem is the first movie kind of cannibalizes a lot of the emotional arcs that really more belong to the adults in the book. And by doing so, you kind of have to run through some of those again. Whereas if you had them being played concurrently, like they work in the book, because by the end of the book, you're cutting back and forth between the adults and kids, like every couple pages.
Well, and chapter two wasn't a guarantee, right? They waited to announce it till the first one did well.
And that's the issue. It chapter one was not made like Lord of the Rings, which if you wanted to make a perfect It adaptation, you would have to make it all at once. Whether you divided it up more individually, I don't know why you wouldn't structure it more like the book, because I think that would, as a filmmaker, give you a lot of fun things to play with, like going into flashbacks and things like that. Like, I feel like you could do tons of cool stuff there, you know, match cuts. You know, they did that in Hill House as well. There's like scenes where a character, where the dad, when he walks in and sees his kids for the first time, it pans around, the kids are adults, it pans to his face, it pans back around, the kids are the children version of the actors, and then when it pans back one more time, they're the adults again. You know, and so you totally understand the mindset that this character is in without doing anything. And yeah, I think breaking it up and having it be that first one was made kind of the way you would make a Spider-Man movie, where you have a whole story and then you put in like a little tease at the end for a sequel, and that's not really it, is one story.
Yeah, I didn't love the second one because I felt like we literally like went and rehashed half of the first one and didn't really do it as well. I didn't really understand why we were seeing, and these were the memories that were bad, but they forgot and they have to go back. It felt very kind of confusing, and I think that they did it because they wanted those kids back. Yeah. Honestly, because I think they were the bigger pull. I think the kids of It were actually the bigger reason people were showing up to the theaters than the adults.
Well, even compared to Pennywise, I think that's what made that first It Chapter 1 work, is that it is so character-driven like the novel is. For long periods, it just feels like a comedy about kids in high school dealing with bullies.
Chapter 2 also lost Chung Chung-hoon, who's one of my favorite cinematographers, and you can tell, no offense to Chapter 2, but it looks like a very different movie, and maybe that was intentional from a directorial standpoint, but that first movie just is so good looking.
I'm going to talk about Maximum Overdrive, Stephen King's directorial debut, because that's the only movie I like by him, and I think it's one of his greatest masterpieces of all time, even though he was high on cocaine when he made the picture, and I love AC/DC music in it.
That's the only movie you like by him? That can't be true.
No, I like others, but that one in particular is my personal favorite by Stephen King, because, again, cocaine, man. Why I think I'm drinking Coke for this special occasion.
Edwin, okay.
Do you have real classic Coke?
No, I don't.
Okay, we're gonna unpack and unwrap a little bit. So, Edwin, Maximum Overdrive, the only movie that Stephen King ever directed. The interesting tidbit, he wanted to cast Bruce Springsteen in the Emilio Estevez role, and he couldn't get Bruce, and so then he really checked out of the movie, and he also found directing really boring, and for somebody who is as ADD as Stephen King, he didn't realize how monotonous directing was. Nevertheless, we showed Maximum Overdrive last week. It's a totally fun movie about some kind of meteor that brings machines alive, and for 5 days, the machines terrorize people, specifically at this truck stop where Emilio Estevez is a very smart, short-order cook. And so, Edwin, why do you love that movie?
I don't know, because it was just a fine, cheesy 80s movie with a kick-ass sound by AC/DC, man. I saw it as a kid, like at 14. I just fell in love with it completely. It's one of my all-time favorite movies by him. He directed and he wrote it. And thank God to Dino De Laurentiis, who, I don't know who went to who, but hey, at least he financed it. And also got him to finance Evil Dead 2, so take that, America.
The way that happened was Dino and Steven, sort of Lady and the Tramp style, each started at the other end of a cocaine line and then met in the middle.
Edwin, what's your favorite scene in Maximum Overdrive?
You know, there's like so many scenes in that movie. My God. I think it would have to be the opening where the machine is telling Stephen King, "F you." No, this machine just called me an asshole. And I just completely laughed my ass off. Especially when the bridge starts opening, there's an amount of chaos that starts happening. That was great.
I have to say, I sat next to Edwin during both Death Proof and Maximum Overdrive, and it was a pleasure to watch Edwin just revel in clearly like his cup of tea.
Exactly. Showing real cinema for once.
In a weird way, like some artists have different periods. You would say, like, Picasso has his blue period, then he has his cubist period. Stephen King, you can kind of divide into his cocaine era and his non-cocaine era. And I don't say that glibly. It's just that King, up until his novel, The Tommyknockers, which I want to say was 87, 88, King admittedly has told people he had a horrible drinking problem. He had a horrible cocaine problem. He was doing a bunch of other things, and he would essentially go up and write, but he would just write kind of like, a lot, you know, like the Beatles or Orson Welles. I mean, a lot of these guys were on uppers or amphetamines, and King would just write, which almost accounted for why he was able to just pound out so much stuff. And eventually his wife, Tabitha, sat him down. It's a very famous story, and just said, look, you know, it's either the drugs or us. But in a very loving way, I think. My understanding is that Tabitha King is very, very supportive. They're still married to this day. And King got it, and he quit, and he went into rehab. And Misery, supposedly, is his metaphorical novel where Annie Wilkins, the nurse, the homicidal nurse, represents drugs. Basically, he was like his biggest fan. That's what Misery is about. And you can tell the books after Misery don't have the same weird whatever it is that the books before Misery have. And then after that inaugurates a new era of Stephen King novels.
I do think there's a third era which starts after his accident.
Oh, totally. Yeah, good call.
It was like the late 90s, right? Early 2000s, somewhere around there.
Dreamcatcher is the first like post-accident novel.
He was like hit by a car and almost died in the late 90s, and it was sort of another awakening for him.
In a very Stephen King way, if folks don't know, King, he hates to waste time. So when he was walking, he would just read, and he would walk this block of road reading while he was exercising. And some guy was coming and not paying attention. He writes about it in the Gunslinger series and basically hits him. And King wasn't paying attention. The guy wasn't paying attention. And King broke all these bones in his body. And he said that's the closest he ever came to just wanting to die, which is very atypical for Stephen King. But he eventually came back. Anyway, if you're asking my favorite Stephen King movie that I would throw here, I find that very hard, because the Stephen King movie, I would probably say The Shining, Stand By Me, Shawshank Redemption, oddly, are three that I love for very different reasons. And obviously, those are totally different books, or totally different adaptations. I would just say that I'm not going to get into Kubrick and The Shining, but what I will say about it is that one of my favorite scenes from the novel is actually where Stephen King talks about that whole weird scene between those two brothers, and the one dresses up like the dog and they have an incestuous relationship, and they're in this room, and they just, the whole book is kind of about how all this horrible stuff just gets imprinted on the hotel. And Stanley Kubrick distills that to one shot. And you just see the brother and the guy in the dog suit when Shelley Duvall realizes it's not all in the mind of her husband and her son, but that the hotel is really haunted. King is actually a devout Christian. King has always been on the books about that. He doesn't like religion, which he's totally on the books about, but he very much loves Jesus and believes in the afterworld. And The Stand is basically his book of dark Christianity. Kubrick, on the other hand, is very skeptical about any kind of afterlife, any kind of God. You know, he has a very understandable Jewish take, which is, after the Holocaust, how could anyone look me in the face and talk about God? There's a famous story when Kubrick called Stephen King. I don't know if you guys know this. The first thing he said to Stephen King is, he was like, "Stephen, your book is very hopeful." And King was like, "What?" And he was like, "Well, any book that posits that there's any kind of afterlife, whatever it is, has got to be a hopeful book." And I think The Shining's interesting because you get a very skeptical guy trying to make a believable ghost story, which creates a really interesting tension. But it's written by somebody who absolutely believes in an afterlife and absolutely believes in God. I think the tension of that in the movie adaptation of The Shining is fascinating.
Because I know that the first Carrie, the book, I haven't read the book, was controversial because of the anti-religious stuff. But I think it's more anti anti-fanaticism, like the church as an organization. I think he tends to have a lot more sympathy to religious people who exist outside of organizations. I think one of the most interesting characters in his books, which actually he was introduced in his second book, Salem's Lot, and became a major character later on, even more so, is Father Callahan, who was a Catholic priest who gets sort of slightly infected or touched by a vampire, and so he can no longer go back into his church. That happens in Salem's Lot, and then he becomes a main character in the Dark Tower series in one of the later books.
With one of the most deep and profound character, like, even though I'm not a huge fan of The Wolves of Cala, I like it a lot, but his whole thing in The Wolves of Cala is brilliant.
Yeah, very, like, tragic figure, but I think he has a lot more respect for people who maybe years of probably being called, like, anti-Christian while also being Christian has imbibed this in him, but he seems to have something specifically for people who have faith, but don't really have that organization, don't have that place to either turn to or rely on too much.
Caitlin, let's come back to you. So as a pop culture writer, Stephen King has just been huge in pop culture now for 30, 40 years, and weirdly continues to be one of the rare cats who's weirdly been relevant for like 40 years. What do you think his contributions are to pop culture?
Wow, that is like the biggest question I think anyone's been asked on this podcast. I think that one of the things that we kind of touched on this earlier is the idea that you can be a pop writer and still like offer something deeper to the world. I think there's this idea that the great books have already been written and have been written like centuries ago. And I do think that that's obviously not true. And I also think that, you know, he's not necessarily only a horror writer. There are obviously books of his that are not strictly horror, but I do think that he has been able to take some really complex themes and put them in these horror novels and then have them be seen as not just sort of like paperback airport novels. And I think that that is probably his biggest, wow, this is a really hard question. This is probably his biggest contribution, is that he has like all these really intense, deep themes that you can present in like a really fun, you know, adaptation that you throw up in the theaters like every Halloween, but then you also get some kind of like deeper things. I mean, I think that we haven't really talked about it, but I think that Carrie is particularly interesting because it was written in the 70s, which was before we really saw like a ton of like school violence. And I think now it holds a lot of weight because I feel like the horror that it was describing is super relevant to like the horror of like today kids in school feel, sort of became really relevant after Columbine. So I think that what he brings to the table is like a lot of these really deep horrors that are kind of always in humanity, he brings them to the surface, and he's able to be both a pop writer, like we were saying, and also someone that I think that nowadays, anyway, people can kind of take seriously and like really analyze. And maybe that's because a lot of his stuff gets adapted from people like Stanley Kubrick and Mike Flanagan. And
I find Carrie to be fascinatingly complex.
Yeah,
at the same time that it's really entertaining.
But Carrie is such a sympathetic figure, and you're with her, and her mother is so oppressive, and yet you almost feel like you see how systems and society can just break someone or something who's inherently good, and how that talent can come out because she's telekinetic. And so the violence is she's trying to be a good person despite all these forces bowling from the mean girls, bowling from her mother, but finally she breaks. And the violence kind of like it just projected outward in this almost uncontrollable yet understandable just catalysm of violence. It's a very complex book.
I think I prefer the book to the movie, though I love the movie and I think Sissy Spacek is amazing. But the book, for anyone who doesn't know, is like written in, there's a word for it, but I can't think of it. It's almost like documents.
It's like found footage for books.
Found footage for books, exactly. And I've actually always thought that it would be a really good idea to do an adaptation of it where you do kind of like a documentary style version of Carrie, and you have it be like maybe modern day, and everybody could, you know, you could see what happened in the gym, in the prom scene, but like from the perspective of people's like cell phones. I think that would be really cool. But yeah, no, I just think it's a really complex book, and it really does honestly like remind me when I read it of reading about like today's like some horrible things that happened today, like when you're reading it, you kind of see like how nothing exists in a vacuum. And it's a lot of factors that kind of create these like tragedies in our real world. So that's kind of why I find Carrie really interesting.
I think Stephen King's biggest contribution to pop culture is he made everyone scared of clowns again.
Yet again, I think we chose a podcast where there's so much to talk about with Stephen King that we may even just come back to him again. Any final thoughts on Stephen King from other team members?
I also really like Creepshow, which he wrote. Not based on a book. He's acting in it. He's a really funny actor. And did anyone else here see the Dark Tower movie? Am I the only one?
No, I saw it.
It's pretty bad. It's actually kind of funny. It feels like a 90s bad movie. And so there's something kind of charming about it. And Matthew McConaughey's performance is so silly. And there's all this stuff about like, he's like, I know you can't defeat my magics. And things like that.
My favorite thing about the Dark Tower movie is rather than have the Hollywood issue of overpromising, where they're like, if this is the first adaptation of the first of seven books, we're going to do seven movies and they never get made. The Dark Tower takes seven books and puts them in a 90-minute movie. The movie is cut to, it's unbelievable. Cut to death. Insanity. Idris Elba, though?
Good cast.
Did they actually end up doing that as a TV series? I know that it was like in the works forever.
I think they're talking about doing Wizard and Glass specifically as a TV series. So we'll see.
I think like Amazon or something has it as a coming soon type of thing.
So let's move on to pop culture and final thoughts. So let's go back to Edwin. Edwin, you've been very patient. I've been very impressed. What are you doing pop culture wise these days?
Nothing really. I went to CD Trader and I got that Say Anything poster, which is a incredible find. It was a bitch to get down the bus all the way from the valley. And I stopped at Palermo's to get pizza, and I had the poster right next to me, so no one could take it. If they would take it, I would probably kill them. And I am about to bench watch Daniel's Bruce Lee box set, which I'm starting with The Game of Death. So that should be a fun watch, because I liked The Game of Death a lot. It's one of my favorite Bruceploitation movies.
Well, I kind of mentioned it like 25 times already, but if you haven't seen The Haunting of Bly Manor, I really recommend it. I don't know if anybody has seen The Turning. No, just me. Yeah, I went to like a press screening, and I think I was like one of like 20 people there. So I don't think it got that much attention, but Turning of the Screw. Turn of the Screw?
Yeah, head to Henry James.
Turn of the Screw.
Yeah, I'm actually reading right now, I'm reading Turn of the Key, which is another adaptation of it. But yeah, Haunting of Bly Manor is really, really beautiful. I won't spoil it, but at the end there is some very It, like Stephen King's It stuff happening.
I'm not completely done with it, but like Hill House, it has a lot to do with like, a lot of the ghosts are really just trauma.
Yes, the ending episode is all that. Really, and a lot of some mental health stuff and memory and storytelling. It's really a wonderful show. It's a pretty quick binge too. I think most of my friends have texted me about it after watching it in like 3 days. So.
And it's wonderfully gay.
Wonderfully gay. I know. Victoria Benretti is like, I love her very much.
And Caitlin, if we want to read your pop culture writing or listen to your podcast, where can we go?
Podcast is the Riverdale Register. I recommend only listening to it if you like Riverdale and want to learn more. About it, because we recap all of the old episodes, or all of the episodes. We'll start up again for sure with the recaps when season 5 premieres. And that's on Apple Podcasts, we're on SoundCloud, etc., etc. I kind of have work all over the internet now, Refinery29. Currently I'm at E! News, which is mostly just celebrity stuff and kind of quick hits. And then on Twitter, I am at Riley Tweets, R-E-I-L-L-Y Tweets.
Yeah, I watched for my friend's movie night last week a movie called After Last Season, which is a genuine good-bad movie treat. Most good-bad movies, you don't even think about this, but most good-bad movies are good by their nature of being funny. That's the aspect that's good. And while After Last Season is that, definitely, it's also eerie. It is so bad, it's scary, but actual. This is a couple sentences I'm going to read that I wrote about it. If Tommy Wiseau is an alien from another planet who's come to Earth to make American films, then After Last Season was made by a bunch of people who were abducted by those aliens and then forced to make a film under duress. They essentially made a more compact version of Twin Peaks The Return that has the production quality of a beheading video and feels like it is truly cursed. Wikipedia states that the film grossed so little in the few theaters it was shown at, the film's reels were destroyed as this was cheaper than returning them. What Wikipedia doesn't say is that destroying the film after watching it is the only way to prevent the Shadow Man from entering your dreams. If you can find After Last Season, it was tough. If you can find it, I would maybe recommend it.
Where did you find it?
A friend of mine found it for me. It's on the deep well. He found it in a well.
Under a hotel. It was weird.
Yeah, it was very strange. I had to answer several riddles. If you like that kind of thing, like I do, that kind of weird, it's about, I don't know what it's about. To put the cognitive dissonance in even simpler terms, some of the sets are made of cardboard. It was made in 2009, and it was shot on film. So all three of those things are true about this film. And I'm on Twitch at twitch.tv/ConnorCruz.
Turner Classic Movies, since September, is doing a great series every Tuesday called Women Make Film. And every Tuesday is themed. This week's theme was bodies and sex. Next week's is home, religion, and work. And the final week of October is politics, gear change, and comedy. And it's just like a whole night of great or like lesser scene. Some of them I've never heard of. All directed by women. It's a very cool series, and there's like a 9 or 10 part documentary that comes out each week with it that's really fascinating. I started two books that Jordan from our South Korean podcast recommended me. One of them's called Perimeters of Disavowal, Colonial Representation in South Korean Cinema, and the other one's called Korea's Place in the Sun, A Modern History, that's about the film industry and South Korea as a whole that are really fascinating and kind of a good intro read to get into like the heavy politics and dynamics of Korean culture. And finally, this month, my favorite band is The National, and the lead singer, Matt Berninger, is putting out a solo album that everything I've heard from is pretty incredible called Serpentine Prison. And I also discovered this new guy, his name is Barty Strange. And I've never listened to an album that just, you can't slap a genre on. It runs the gamut of like, it's got like some punk stuff. It's got some like rap and R&B elements. It's got like this country song. It's got like emo dynamics. It is a wild listen, and I can't recommend it enough.
I will just say we didn't get to it, and as everyone was saying, we're going to have to revisit Stephen King again, but Connor had animated it. One of my favorite Stephen King novels is actually the fourth Dark Tower book, Wizard in Glass, and for anybody who hasn't done Stephen King's Gunslinger series, actually, if you read all seven novels in totality, it's very powerful, very effective. I actually would say it succeeds, even though, like a lot of these seven-book things, you know, there's some that are better than others, but I would say even the least of the Dark Tower novels is wildly entertaining, and I got something out of it. And I mean that.
Probably the sixth one?
But yeah, but even the sixth one has that great restaurant with like the vampires, which is like crazy, and it still totally sets the table for the seventh one. But
did you read 4.5, The Wind Through the Keyhole?
I did. Yeah, there are eight of them, and I love Wind in the Keyhole. I'm sorry, the eighth book, I should say. He loved the world so much, he went back and wrote a standalone book with the characters that would come between.
I think it's 4 and 5.
Is it? Oh, okay. But I would just say about Wizard in Glass, it's this weird book where weirdly he does this thing that shouldn't work, which is at the moment of the highest narrative tension, he stops and tells a story about what happened to the main character decades ago.
Like an origin story.
And yet that origin story is such a powerful love story and so important for who his character is, Roland the Gunslinger, and where that character will end up, and is such a powerful Western and has such fascinating characters. I highly recommend that either people read the Gunslinger series, but I would put Wizard in Glass as one of the great American novels of the last 40 years that no one knows about, even though I know a lot of people read it because it's Stephen King. Anyway, that's my pop culture. Also, I will just say we are 3 weeks away from the election. It is, we are recording this on October 12th, literally the 19th, the 26th. We are 3 weeks away from the election. Go to vote.org. Please register if you have your ballot. You know what? Fill it out, send it in. The sooner that you vote, the sooner they can start counting them. If you're in any of the swing swing states. I will say them again. Don't take any of these states for granted. Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Texas, Iowa, Ohio, Arizona, Nevada. All of those states are in play. The more people that vote, even if people try to mess with the vote, they can't mess with all the votes. So just get out there. And the more people that vote, the less likely there's going to be messing with votes that really affect this. So I'm not telling you how to vote. I'm just begging you. It matters. I reject cynicism completely. And I'm a 43-year-old. So F cynicism. I just said it. I'm a skeptic, but I'm not a cynic. I believe that things can be turned around. So vote. Please vote. Your vote counts. Edwin is registered to vote. I'm registered to vote. Daniel's registered to vote. Connor's registered to vote. Caitlin, are you registered to vote?
Of course.
There you go. Vote. You can check out all the movies we're doing, secretmovieclub.com. Caitlin, I want to give you the last word. This was kind of an unwieldy podcast. It was always an honor to have you on, and you said a lot of great stuff. You get the last word. Say whatever you want to say.
Oh, man. The voting thing was really good. Get out there and vote. I kind of want to end on that because I'm terrified. I just upped some anxiety medication for the next couple of weeks. We're gonna be fine.
Give us our famous sign off.
Mine.
Our famous sign off.
You can make it up.
Oh, I make. There is no famous sign off.
No, Craig keeps doing this. He keeps throwing to the guests at the end, like, you bring us out. They're like,
Well, I was already very nervous about the what is Stephen King's contribution. So this is also a lot of pressure. Have a wonderful, safe, happy Halloween in a couple of weeks.
Boom. That's what we say. Caitlin, you got it right.
For getting the phrase correct, you've just won $1,000.
Oh my gosh.
Paid you by Edwin
in DVDs.
I'll just take that Say Anything poster, actually.
All right. If anyone tells you to Say Anything poster, you will die.
Red, Edwin, roll the poster up, put it in a tube.
Come on.
Whoa. I'm going out. Edwin picked up a hammer.
That's right.
You watched Old Boy this weekend.
I got a hammer and I know how to use this, man.
Okay, Edwin, let's put the hammer down and go back to Hopeful Sayings. No one's taking your Say Anything poster. Put the hammer down. Deep breaths. Are you looking forward to voting on November 3rd?
No.
Are you going to vote on November 3rd?
Yes.
Edwin, I'm proud of you. For somebody as apolitical as you are, I'm going to take that.
I take that. I take that as a win. So
thank you for voting, Edwin. And that's it, guys. Caitlin, thank you for being on the show. Everybody have a good week.
Thank you.
We'll see you soon. Peace out, homie.
Bye.
My method for starting anything is I tell myself the story. When I'm laying in bed at night, before I go to sleep, I'll tell myself this story. And so at some point, probably 9 months after this, because this is what it's like, you know, a little piece of grit and it makes a pearl after a while. You just have to give it time. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't. But a lot of times it does.